We are, as you know, about to complete the rules for the standard model. So then we'll know everything. And then we get to reap the reward. We get to have a bunch of fun discussing, you know, what it's all about. What are the sort of patterns and puzzles in the standard model that need explaining? What are learning about the physics in various ways? So anyway, that's what we'll get to in a moment. But before we do that, let's go back and finish the last unfinished slide of the previous lecture. Oops. So we were almost at the end of finding all of the interaction vertices from the standard model. We had gone through line by line and the first, second, and fourth lines, and we just didn't have time to cover the guys coming from the third line. What do you think? I don't know. So now I'm. Oh, can I change the color of my? Okay. I feel okay. I don't know.
I've also changed the duration that it lasts.
Uh huh.
I guess.
I like the duration. Now I'm realizing I don't like the color, but oh well. You know what? I'm gonna see if I can change the color and then come back next time. I'm gonna try the highlighter one more time. So here we go. The third line of the standard model Lagrangian, basically the kinetic terms for the permeants. Okay, so to get the quadratic part, we dropped the covariant. We dropped the connection fields from the covariant derivative. So we already have two fields appearing in each of these terms. So if we just kept the partial, we had a quadratic term. This time we're going to instead keep the connection term and see what interaction vertices that we get. So we get a bunch of cubic terms. So in particular, if we let's first talk about the interaction vertices that we get involving the gauge, the SU3 gauge field G. Well, that of course only appears in the kinetic terms for the quarks, because in these remaining two kinetic terms for the leptons, they transform trivially under SU3, so the gluon field just doesn't appear in those terms. But it does appear in the first three, so any of the three quark fields, that's what my capital Q means. Capital Q, by the way, could be little q left or little u right or little d right, but it could also be the little q, it could be the little u and little d Dirac fields that we defined last time, four component fields, or after spontaneous symmetry breaking, it doesn't matter. In any case, if you expand out this kinetic term and just focus on the term that involves the gluon fields, well, we have I times the SU3 gauge coupling times the eight SU3 generators. The lambda I here runs from 1 through 8, and each of these is a matrix with two gauge indices, SU3 indices, times the gluon field. G slash, which, sorry, I this is a notational error. I should either have the slash or the mu there, but sorry, that I shouldn't have the mu there. That should be a gamma mu. So we, just as we did before, we strip off the three fields now, the two quark fields and the gluon field. And we label the three external lines of the corresponding vertex by them. And then the rest of it, the rest of the term here, tells us the vertex factor we're supposed to write down. If we multiply it by an I, so that's what we get. The vertex factor here is minus I G3, the gamma matrix that was involved in this slash, and the lambda matrix. So in other words, this is saying that if a quark of color, the quark of color B comes in and emits a gluon field of type I and turns into a quark of color A, the vertex vector for that to happen is minus I times the gauge coupling for SU3 times the gamma matrix corresponding to the polarization of this gluon field, times the ABth element of the ith lambda matrix. the ith Gell-Mann matrix. Okay, so this is all just a number. Once we specify the color of the incoming quark, the color of the outgoing quark, and the type of gluon that gets emitted. Okay, that would be the vertex factor if you were ever doing a gory enough calculation where you needed to know that. But just to know the principle, that's the, you know, that's the idea. Okay, so much for vertices where the gluon field appears. What about the weak bosons? Well, let's do this in two steps. Let's first think about the vertices where the W bosons appear. So if you think about where they appear in these kinetic terms, well, they only appear in the kinetic terms for the left-handed fields, because only the left-handed fields transform non-trivially under SU2, so only the Q left field and the L left field. And so in those guys, if you now expand out how they appear, the connection term, you know, the W plus and minus bosons, remember, were linear combinations of the W1 and W2 bosons, which were multiplying the generators sigma 1 and sigma 2, the two poly sigma matrices, which are both off diagonal. And so those two bosons end up living off diagonal in a 2x2 matrix that lives in between this copy of Q left and this copy of Q left bar. And so since it's off diagonal, you see that this interaction, you know, it doesn't means that a W, it's saying that when we multiply these two vectors with an off diagonal matrix in between, we're only going to get a non-zero term where U left bar multiplies D left, or where D left bar multiplies U left. So in other words, we're only going to get vertices like this, where the type of quark that comes in is one type, the up type, and the type of quark that comes out is the other type, down type. And then whatever W boson gets emitted will be the type that's needed to conserve electric charge in the process. And then the one other important thing to say here, okay, so again, just reading off what the, or, you know, if we strip off the fields from this term and call everything else the vertex factor, we can read off that the vertex factor is something like this. Or the one other thing to mention here is that so far I've been describing this in terms of the fields U and D that appear directly in the Lagrangian, but remember that to define the mass eigenstates, the mass eigenstates were not these D lefts. We had to rotate by the CKM matrix to get the mass eigenstates D left prime. So if we want the actual vertex for an incoming mass eigenstate of the up quark to go into a mass eigenstate of the down quark, the D left bar, we'll see that the vertex factor will include an appropriate element of this CKM matrix. And so in particular, because this CKM matrix is not a diagonal matrix in the IJ space, it means that this diagram has the important property, it's the only one of these vertices on this page, that has the property that it converts, you know, this is saying that an up quark of the first generation can come in, so I could be one here, first generation up quark, it could convert into a down quark of, let's say, the third generation here. So in other words, a bottom quark. Or I should say a mass eigenstate down quark of the third generation, i.e. a bottom quark, but that in that diagram, if an up quark went to a bottom quark, I would have to include, according to this rule, the 1-3 component of the CKM matrix, part of the vertex factor. Okay, but so this is so you say in the standard model, this is a so-called charged current interaction, because in the Lagrangian, whenever just like in the Lagrangian for electromagnetism, the thing that multiplies a mu is the electric current. And in general, if you look in the Lagrangian, the thing that multiplies any vector boson is the corresponding quote unquote current coupled to that boson. So here what we're looking at is the diagram coming from the charged current interaction in the standard model, charged current because the boson here is a charged boson. And so one says that the charged current interaction in the standard model does change flavor. Change flavor in particle physics speak means it converts things, particles of one generation into particles of a different generation, can do so. By contrast, as we'll see in the final point here, the neutral currents in the standard model, the neutral current interactions, so these the interactions with the A and Z bosons, which are electrically neutral, those do not change flavor. Those always convert fermions from the first generation into other fermions from the first generation, etc. So, but let's see how that goes. Okay, so now let's just be a little more general here in this term. So this is, you know, any fermion in the standard model, any of the fermions we've been interested in. And so now the kinetic term, if we focus on the part involving the two gauge bosons we haven't dealt with yet, you know, we've already looked at the G gauge boson and the W1 and W2. The remaining two that we haven't are W3 and B. So if we look at how they enter, you know, the W3 boson is always multiplied by IG2 times the generator T3, which is appropriate to this fermion. So if this is a left-handed fermion, then this T3 would be the 1/2 times the Pauli sigma matrix. But if this was a right-handed fermion, this T3 would be 0. And then the B boson enters with I times the U1 gauge coupling constant times the charge Y of this fermion. Okay. And then now W3 and B are not the physical bosons that appear after spontaneous symmetry breaking. So we can use the transformations that we learned between those two bosons and the actual physical Z and Z boson and photon to rewrite this whole thing in brackets as we do in the next line. In which case, you can check that now the Z boson is multiplied by this thing, which we can call the sort of effective coupling constant for the Z boson, whereas the photon is multiplied by this quantity, where E, this particular combination of the SU2 and U1 gauge couplings, is the electromagnetic gauge coupling, otherwise known as the electric charge. And this this guy here, Q, is the, you know, dimensionless electric charge of each particular field. So this is the guy that's -1 for the electron and 2/3 for the up quark, etc. Okay, so that's saying that, you know, the vertex factor for any charged fermion can be moving along here and emit a photon, and the amplitude to do so is proportional to this vertex factor, which is what we read off from this term after stripping off the three fields in this term. So we just see that it's always proportional. The amplitude for that to happen is proportional to the charge of the fermion in question, whereas the corresponding amplitude for it to emit a Z boson, well, that depends in a more complicated way on the properties of the fermion. It depends, we see, on whether it's it depends on this G effective guy. So it depends on whether it's a left or right-handed fermion, and it also depends on what its hypercharge is. So this is the most complicated to describe what the coupling constant is. But anyway, it's just this whatever this thing is. So it's a lot like electromagnetism, except the coupling constant, it's not just the simple electric charge, it's this weirder function of the chirality and the hypercharge of the fermion. Okay, there you go. So that's the standard model. We've, in principle, gone from the most basic logical starting point as we currently understand it to the rules of the game. Those are the particles and their interaction vertices. So now, you know, if you want to know what processes are allowed in nature, what particles can turn into what particles, the answer is, well, if you can take those vertices we just wrote down and find a way to connect them up so that the external lines for the ingoing particles and outgoing particles, you can write down some graph that connects them, then that's an allowed process in fundamental physics. And to calculate the amplitude for that process that you would square to get the probability, you just have to calculate the you have to use the Feynman rules to calculate the amplitude for that diagram and for all possible diagrams you can think of that connect the initial legs and to the final legs that you might want. So this thing is incredibly successful. This model that we've just described, the minimal standard model with no right-handed neutrinos and just the renormalizable Lagrangian. However, setting aside unexplained puzzles about it, it does not agree with nature. It is there are three things about nature that it strictly does not, that it's strictly in contradiction with. So the minimal renormalizable standard model. So those are, first of all, that it predicts, as we've seen, that the neutrinos are massless and don't oscillate. And whereas neutrinos are observed to have masses and oscillate, the minimal standard model does not have any dark matter candidate in it, whereas the universe around us seems to have dark matter. And then it also cannot explain the observed cosmic asymmetry between matter and antimatter. So at early times, there had to be one more proton. For every billion antiprotons, there had to be a billion and one protons, so that when it got cool enough for protons and antiprotons to annihilate, a billion of them annihilated, but one in a billion was left over. One in a billion protons was left over at the end of the day. So there was an tiny excess of matter, which is what fills the universe today. And so, you know, that sounds like a small amount, but it's actually, problem is that the minimal standard model cannot explain how that much of an asymmetry could have been present at early times to leave us with, the excess that we see today.
What is that oscillation for neutrinos?
Yeah, we'll get to that when we talk about. So it turns out that for the up and down quarks, that there was this distinction between the mass eigenstates and the weak eigenstates. So weak eigenstates, what I mean by that is that one way to say that is that, you know, if I had in this interaction here, if I work in terms of the U and D quarks, then a U quark of the first generation always goes to a D quark of the first generation. A U quark of the second generation always goes to a D quark of the second generation. So the 3x3 matrix describing the interaction between the incoming quark and the outcoming quark is diagonalized in that basis. So those are called the weak eigenstates of the weak interaction. However, we saw that those were not the same as the mass eigenstates. We had to define these new guys, D prime, that diagonalize the mass matrix. So once you include a mass for the right-handed for the neutrino, and the easiest way to see it is once you include a right-handed neutrino. I think I just said once you include a mass for the neutrino, probably by including right-handed neutrinos, but one way or another, there is a similar discrepancy between the weak eigenstates and the mass eigenstates. So if you think in terms of one or the other, you see oscillations between types in the other basis. We'll talk about it. But those two things are almost equivalent. So these are three key things that are not explained by the standard model. We'd like to understand how they're explained. Probably they're explained by right-handed neutrinos, one per generation, but we don't know that for sure, but we'll be seeing how that can elegantly account for all of these three things, and then how it elegantly fits into the sort of completes some natural patterns in the standard model, and so let's talk about that. That's going to be the main subject of today's lecture. So. We've done the hard work of learning how the standard model works. So now we get to reap the benefits and have the fun of sort of understanding the model a little bit better. So the next two lectures, I want to describe some very beautiful but unexplained patterns in the standard model that seem to me to be like some of the most basic things you need to, I think, are very important aspects of understanding the standard model, because they seem to be the organizing patterns that sort of make sense of what is otherwise a very very messy table that we've been dealing with so far. Okay, so as a warm up, let me just briefly remind you of this point about linear algebra, because it'll be important to be clear about this in what follows. So I remind you, if we have a vector space V an m-dimensional vector space, so it has some m basis vectors v1 through vm, and we have another vector space w whose basis vectors are w1 through wn, so it's an n-dimensional vector space. Then there's two basic operations that we can do with those two vector spaces. We can add them, we can take the so-called direct sum, and that just means we form the, this is just the vector space where we take the union of the previous two bases. We take all the basis vectors v1 through vm and w1 through wn, and we take all linear combinations of those basis vectors. So that vector space is m plus n dimensional. The other thing we can do is to find the tensor product of those two vector spaces, v tensor w. So that means we take the pair, for every pair of the ith basis element of v and the jth basis element of w, we formally think of this combination, this product, as a basis element of a new vector space. And we let ourselves take all linear combinations of basis elements of this type. Well, how many of them are there? There are m times n such basis vectors. So this is an m times n dimensional vector space. Okay? Okay, so I say all that because now I want to sort of explain this first beautiful pattern about the standard model. We'd like to, it's good to switch notation here. So here's the table that we've been using so far. I just want to first rewrite that table in an equivalent but different looking notation, which is shown in this column. So what's the idea here? Let's look at the first row. Okay, so I'm just rewriting the Hilbert space of fermions and antifermions in the standard model in the following way. So here, this we said Q left in term, if we forget about its space-time indices for a moment, that it's remaining, it has a bunch of remaining indices. The tensor, it transforms to some sort of tensor with respect to the group SU3 times SU2 times U1. It has a bunch of indices like a tensor does, but they come in different types. So in particular, it lives in a three-component vector space because it transforms as a triplet under SU3. But then tensored with a two-component vector space because it transforms as doublet under SU2. And then, well, this is just for notational purposes. It doesn't really change the dimension of the vector space, but I'll write another tensor C1 here, tensor C, and then the subscript, I'll write, I wrote a subscript 1 here because, okay, sorry. This last factor, this last factor is recording the C1 charge, is recording the U1 hypercharge, but I'm now going to switch convention to sort of mathematician's convention. As I said, physicists for historical reasons normalize this column so that the numbers are all fractions, whereas actually mathematically it makes more sense to have one-dimensional representations labeled by integers. The reason that we can do that is that if you think about how the U1 charges, how the hypercharges appear in the standard model Lagrangian, well, they only appear in the covariant derivatives acting on those fields, and they always appear in combination with, they always appear in a product, the hypercharge times the G1 gauge coupling. So since it's only this product which is actually physical, I can always change my convention and increase hypercharges by some common factor, as long as I simultaneously decrease the gauge coupling by the same factor. So that's what I'm going to do. Compared to our previous convention, compared to, let's say, the standard physicist's convention, I'm now going to increase all of the hypercharges by a factor of 6 to turn them all into integers, which means that I'm working in a convention now where the coupling constant G1 is 1/6 of what I would have previously called it. Anyway. Just a detail. Just to say that. So that's why. In this last factor, whereas this guy has hypercharge 1/6, but here I'm labeling it with a subscript 1 to indicate that charge. This guy has hypercharge 2/3. So in this last U1 factor, I'm labeling that by a subscript 4. In other words, 6 times 2/3. et cetera, minus one third, labeling by minus two. So yeah, so this last factor is just saying that when I choose the when I pick a U1 gauge transformation e to the I phi, that's acting on this factor by e to the 1 times I phi, e to the 4 times I phi, e to the minus 2 times I phi, etc. Okay, so I hope this notation is clear. So these six rows here are exactly just another re-expression of these six rows here. Now, you know, in the standard model, there's particles and there's antiparticles. So we saw before that for each field Q, for each field like Q left, we could define the corresponding charge conjugate field or antiparticle field. So remember that the antiparticle, the antifield, the antifermion is defined as by taking the complex conjugate of the original field and then rotating it by I times gamma 2, so that these two guys now both transform like Dirac fermions under Lorentz transformations. But if Q left transformed in a certain way under gauge transformations, so for example under SU3, Q left was multiplied by SU3 matrix U3, so we say it transformed in the three-dimensional representation. Well, the charge conjugate field Q left C, that's going to transform instead with the complex conjugate of the matrix U3. So that's actually an inequivalent representation called the three bar. It's still three-dimensional, but it's inequivalent in the sense that there's no change of basis you can do that converts every U3 bar matrix into the original U3 basis. So they're genuinely inequivalent representations. So physicists use the notation 3 and 3 bar to distinguish those two notations. More generally, for SUN, you know, if you pick an element of SUN, then the representation that maps that element to exactly that same matrix, that's called the n-dimensional representation, the n, but the one that maps it to the complex conjugate matrix, that's called the n-bar representation. And in general, the n-bar and the n are different inequivalent representations, but for what we're going to say in a moment, it's important to know that there is one special exception to that, which we already saw when we encountered the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson, remember, transformed as a doublet under SU2, but then we took the complex conjugate, which you would think, if this guy transformed as the 2, you would think this guy transforms as the 2 bar. But we were able to do a little change of basis here to define a new field H twiddle, which also transformed as the 2. We were able to do that because for SU2 and SU2 alone, it turns out that the n and the n bar, the 2 and the 2 bar, actually are equivalent. It's just change of basis you can do. It converts every complex conjugate of a matrix into the original matrix. So with that said, with those little bits of background, we can now, you know, immediately go from the left-hand column here to the representations on the right-hand column. So if Q left transforms like this, then the charge conjugate field Q left bar transforms like the three C. I've called this C3 star to indicate this is a three-dimensional complex space but it transforms not as the 3 but as the 3 bar. The 2 becomes the 2 star, but the 2 star we just said is equal to the 2, so I've just called it, so that guy doesn't change. And C1, well, that picks up a factor of e to the plus 1 times I phi, so when we complex conjugate the field, it would pick up a factor of e to the minus 1 times I phi. So it has charge minus 1. So in a similar way, I just take all these representations and conjugate them. You get the corresponding representations on the other side. So we have these 12 representations, which represent the way the six different types of particles and antiparticles in the standard model transform. So now I just want to do one more thing before to set us up to see this beautiful pattern, which is instead of splitting the fields into particles and antiparticles, I want to split them up in a different way. I've color-coded them according to whether they are left-handed fermions, meaning that they live in the upper two components of the Dirac spinner, or right-handed fermions. So all the blue fields, you know, so this blue field is a left-handed fermion, we said. Now the upright is a right-handed fermion, but its charge conjugate is a left-handed fermion. So this is left-handed. Similarly with D-right, its charge conjugate field is left-handed. Left-handed lepton is left-handed, but the right-handed neutrino, we have to charge conjugate it to make it left-handed. And same with the right-handed electron, we need to charge conjugate it to make it left-handed. So collecting all the left-handed fields down here, we have one generation's worth of left-handed fields, which I'll call the F for one family. Consists of Q left, U right C, E right C, L left, U right C, and E right C. And then here we have the corresponding green guys, or the corresponding right-handed fields. This is just the charge conjugate of the left-handed representation is this right-handed representation, all the one generation of right-handed fermions. And if you count up how many dimensions are in a single, are in F, well, it's 6 for the left-handed quark, 3 colors times 2 doublet times the 2 for SU2, 3 for the right-handed quark, because it just has colors, 3 for the right-handed down quark, because it just has 3 colors, 2 for the left-handed lepton doublet, because it has a new left and an e left, and just 1 for the right-handed neutrino and right-handed electron. If you add those up, that's 16, a 16-dimensional representation in total for F, and FC is 16 more. So the total dimension for a single generation of fermions and antifermions in the standard model is 32 dimensions, okay? 32 is 2 to the 5, and so that fact is sort of the first indication of the pattern that we're about to see.
I didn't get exactly why the complex conjugate is not trivial and something independent.
You can think of it in terms of maybe counting the number of independent real numbers in the field. So if you have a real scalar field, that describes one independent degree of freedom per Fourier mode. So if you fix K, then specify the state in the Fock space. All you have to tell me is how many particles at that K are created. But if I had a complex scalar field, then telling me how many particles there are at a given k does not tell me what vector in the Hilbert space is. It tells me how many particles there are at that k, but also how many antiparticles. Like when you're splitting the field, remember with a real field, you may remember that the way you decompose it into is you write it as a Fourier sum of solutions of the wave, positive frequency solutions of the wave equation, e to the I k dot x, times annihilation operators for the for that Fourier mode, plus corresponding negative frequency solutions times the creation operators. Corresponding creation operators, but if this were, that would be the correct expansion if this was a real field. But then, if this was a complex field, then the Fourier modes here and here are not related. And similarly, when you promote them to operators, they're not related to one another. Instead, you need a separate should be B K dagger. This is the field is a mixture of the annihilation operator of the particle and the creation operator for the corresponding antiparticle. So, yeah, when you go to complex fields, you have to keep track of the fact that the positive and negative frequency solutions represent independent degrees of freedom, not related by any reality condition. Basically.
Okay.
Okay, so good. So let's briefly say so the this these first couple patterns that I'm going to describe go under the name of grand unification. That's what they would normally be described as. But I want to clarify that the name grand unification is a little bit misleading here because. So these are here I'm going to sort of summarize the sort of best patterns about the standard model that were discovered in the 1970s. They would have been described in the 1970s as grand unification, but you know, there's really two different things going on here. There's one thing which is just an observed pattern about the standard model itself, which is just an organizing principle, which makes describing what the structure of the standard model is so dramatically neater that it sort of can't be a coincidence. And anyway, it's just a mathematical fact. Then there is but what people meant by grand unification was a second step, which was a thought about what the actual physical model was that explained that mathematical fact. And that was a speculative idea about how the standard model was just a low energy manifestation of a particular type of analogous gauge theory with more gauge bosons and more Higgs fields and maybe more fermion fields that lived at much or that which had a spontaneous symmetry breaking like the Higgs mechanism, but that it took place at much higher energies and where those new analogs of the Higgs field obtained much higher VEVs, et cetera. That's a particular idea. Could be right, could be wrong. If you want to learn more about that, they'll be explaining that idea, the more physical idea, in the Beyond the Standard Model class. That's sort of correctly categorized as a Beyond the Standard Model idea. It's really about some new Lagrangian Beyond the Standard Model. The thing I'm going to tell you about here is not that idea. It's just the underlying group theoretic fact about the standard model itself, the organizing pattern about the standard model. So anyway, just worth keeping that conceptually clear. So what's the idea? Okay, so you know, in the mid-70s, people discovered that the standard model really had this symmetry group, SU3 times SU2 times U1, but that when the Higgs obtained this VEV of about 250 GeV, that although the real symmetry of the theory is this one, that the symmetry that appears to be the case at low energies, if you don't have access to extremely high energy particle colliders or IQ, is this smaller symmetry group. And the idea was, well, people wondered, began to think about, you know, could there be more rungs on this ladder, you know, or is this the top of the ladder, or could there be, you know, an even bigger symmetry group living that includes the standard model gauge group. And maybe, I say, as I say, this is a physical speculation which has not yet received any experimental evidence in its favor, basically. You know, one way, maybe the way we came down from this hypothetical bigger group to the standard model was by some sort of other analog of the Higgs field obtaining a VEV, just like the Higgs VEV down here was responsible for going down the final rung of the ladder. But maybe this new Higgs field or Higgs fields usually has such high VEV that we've just not been able to access any of the phenomenon. That's why we haven't seen any evidence for the for all of the all of the all of the new physics up here. But as I say, this will not be about that, but the basic, but about the best ideas that were discovered in the 70s, still the best ideas, the for the nicest larger groups, which are these three green circled guys, that provide organizing and organizing patterns for the standard model. So the idea is basically this. Well, the smallest, so this is not a simple group because it's a product of three simple groups. The smallest simple group that contains the standard model as a subgroup is SU5. And so the, okay, so one of the important groups in our story will be SU5. There's another, even before SU5 grand unification was discovered, there was another interesting group that was discovered, SU4 times SU2 left times SU2 right. That's called the Patti Salam group. It's not unified, but it's not unified into a single simple group, but it does, in a sense, nicely explain another sort of pattern that's in the standard model. And then there's a slightly bigger group, SO10, or more correctly, SPIN10, the double cover of SO10, in which these are its two maximal subgroups, and it, in a sense, provides the most unified description of the standard model, because now not only is the standard model non-simple group embedded in a simple group, but also the whole set of six different rows in our table, all the six different irreducible representations in one generation, all get grouped into a single representation, and it's a very beautiful representation. It's the left-handed spinner representation of this guy, and then the corresponding right-handed fermions get grouped into the right-handed spinner representation of this guy. So all the particles and antiparticles just end up being grouped into the Dirac spinner representation of this group. So that's what we want to explain. But so the first thing I'll explain is the SU5 story, because that's very beautiful in its own right. And here I'll just summarize the answer, which I'll then describe, you know, explain properly in the remaining 15 minutes of the lecture. So what people discovered, or really this is not how they would have originally phrased it, but over time it's been realized that it has this more elegant way of describing it, is that, okay, so SU5, the smallest group that contains the standard model gauge group, well, it has a very natural vector space associated with it called lambda C5, the so-called exterior algebra, the algebra of forms in five-dimensional space, five-dimensional complex space. This thing has a natural way that it transforms under SU5. This thing transforms as a certain representation of SU5. But then, if you now restrict back from SU5 to the actual standard model gauge group, this very natural object breaks up. It breaks up into 12 different irreducible representations of the standard model, which are exactly the 12 different representations coming from a single generation of fermions and antifermions in the standard model. So
what do you mean by transforms?
Okay, so good question. I'll explain that more in a moment. But what I mean to say is that just like each of the fields in the standard model, like the left-handed quark field or the right-handed, they each have a certain way that they that if you do a gauge transformation, the different components of that field get transformed into one another. So they transform as some representation, as I often say. In a similar sense, this thing, this object, the exterior algebra, has a natural way. Well, I mean, I haven't told you what it is yet, but as soon as I explain what it is, you'll see it has a natural way that it automatically transforms under SU5. Transforms again as some representation now of the group SU5. But the point is that now that one object, this thing which transforms as one unified object under SU5, once I break SU5 down to this subgroup, once I restrict it to this subgroup, it breaks up into 12 different things, which magically are just exactly the 12 different representations of particles and antiparticles. So that's the basic punchline, and I just want to show you exactly what that is about. Okay, so let's first think about how we would embed SU3 times SU2 times U1 in SU5. Remember, this is the group of 5 by 5 unitary matrices with determinant 1. Okay, so to see how to embed it, first remember what it means that to be SU3 times SU2 times U1. It means that if we take a triplet of elements, U3, U2, and alpha, which are elements of SU3, SU2, and U1 respectively, and multiply it by another such triple, they sort of multiply in this way. Each element in the triplet multiplies separately. So, you know, that means that each sort of factor in this group commutes with every other factor. You know, an element of U3, an element of SU3 is an element like this. An element of SU2 is an element like this. If I multiply them, I get an element like this. But I could have equally well multiplied those elements in the opposite order and gotten, according to the above multiplication rule, the same answer. So this is equal to this, i.e. the two groups commute. So now I have to somehow embed SU3 and SU2 in a 5 by 5 matrix, a 5 by 5 unitary determinant 1 matrix, in a way where the SU2 part and the SU3 part will commute with each other. Well, it's easy to see how to do that. You just have to put them in separate blocks in the matrix. I'll put my SU2 matrix in the upper 2 by 2 block, put my SU3 matrix in the lower 3 by 3 block, and then if I multiply two elements of that form, you know, you can see those two elements will commute with each other as 5 by 5 matrices because the two blocks only talk to one another. What I mean, that was very confusing what I just said. If I take an element that is of the form, so if I use that embedding and then I take an element of the form, it just has an SU3 part, but the SU2 part is 1, and an element that just has an SU2 part, but the SU3 part is 1, then two matrices like this that are, if the SU3 and SU2 parts are embedded in these two blocks like this, then... Does anyone understand what I'm saying, or should I write it out more correctly? It's okay. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, sorry. I apologize. Good. So now... that's how you embed SU3 and SU2. What about U1? Well, here's an element of U1. I need to embed it as a 5 by 5 matrix now in a way that it's a 5 by 5 unitary matrix that is has determinant 1 and also commutes with both SU2 and SU3. So here's my U1 element. Well, in order for it to commute with any element of SU2, I better have it sort of be some appearing as some multiple of the 2 by 2 identity matrix here, so the 2 by 2 identity matrix will just pass through any element of SU2, and down here I better have it multiplying some function of it multiplying the 3 by 3 identity matrix, so that it commutes right through this SU3 element, and then I also need the determinant of this whole matrix to be equal to 1 because it's supposed to be an element of SU5, so. But I can do that too. You can see that'll be achieved if I take power alpha to the 3 here, because and alpha to the minus 2 here, because then if you think about the determinant of this matrix, I'll get two powers of alpha to the 3 coming from the upper two diagonal components here. That'll give me an alpha to the 6. I'll get three powers of alpha to the minus 2 coming from the lower three diagonal components here. And those will multiply to alpha to the 0, so the determinant of this matrix will indeed be 1. So, to make a long story short, the embedding of SU3 times SU2 times U1 in SU5 is like this. I take my element U3, U2, and alpha, and I write it as a 5 by 5 matrix, like so. Okay?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
We have a degeneracy here when we want to like describe some element of SU3 times SU2 times like U1 in SU5, why it's not a problem? Like, we can have many elements of, like, many combinations of SU3 and SU2 and, like, U1 that can correspond to the same element in SU5.
That's a good point. Sorry?
But we don't care about it?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I had eliminated, for time purposes, a slide about that and put it at the end here in case there was time. Let's get there if there's time. That's a very good point, and it's a very interesting point. Exactly. There's really six different elements of SU3 times SU2 times U1 that give rise to the same SU5 matrix according to this embedding. So that's saying that if this whole embedding story is correct, that really the gauge group of the standard model is not SU3 times SU2 times U1, but the very closely related group, SU3 times SU2 times U1 mod Z6. And all observations are consistent with that, because if you actually ask how do each of the particles in the standard model transform under those six different elements, they actually do all transform exactly the same way. So it's as if there's a degeneracy. Or in other words, there's actually six different elements of the standard model gauge group, the identity element, but five other non-identity elements that actually also all act trivially on all the particles in the standard model, don't transform them at all. So that seems compatible with this idea that actually the full group is actually not this big group, but 1/6 of this group where you mod up. But let's get there. Okay, so. Next, I need to tell you what is the exterior algebra, lambda cn. So this is the algebra of forms, p forms, in n-dimensional complex space. You may have met differential forms, one forms, two forms, etc. in GR. There, those are forms living in those are elements of the exterior algebra, lambda. R4. That's because this 4 is because the vector space in that case is the tangent space in a four-dimensional space-time is a four-dimensional vector space. And it's a real manifold, so the tangent space is a real vector space. So the forms in that vector space are elements of lambda R4. So, but we want to describe the analogous thing, but where the vector space is a complex vector space, and now first for n dimensions, but then the case that'll be relevant for the standard model will be the case where it's a five-dimensional complex space. Okay, but first, again, let's start with the general n-dimensional space. So suppose we have n-dimensional complex vector space. So it has n basis elements, e1 through en. So that's an n-dimensional vector space. I will call those now. The one forms, the space of one forms in Cn. So I'll call that lambda 1 Cn. What about the two forms? Well, what are those? Well, now I imagine taking the tensor product of Cn with itself. So remember, that's the space spanned by all basis vectors of the form Ei tensor Ej. So that's an n squared dimensional space. But I'm not going to consider that whole space to get the two forms. Instead, I'm only going to consider the subspace, the two forms, lambda 2 Cn. That's the space of basis vectors that are where I've anti-symmetrized over I and j. So I don't consider arbitrary combinations Ei Ej separately. I only consider the combination Ei tensor Ej minus Ej tensor Ei. And I only let myself take linear combinations of basis elements of that form. So if you count it up, you'll see that that space has only n choose two dimensions, smaller subspace. So that's the space of two forms. And more generally, the space of p forms, well, that's where I start with the tensor product, p tensor products of C with itself. So the sum of all basis vectors of the form Ei tensor dot 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 up to Ej, where there's p copies of the E. So that space naively has n to the p dimensions. But again, I'm going to look at the subspace. The p forms are the space of p forms is the subspace where I only consider, you know, combinations of basis vectors Ei tensor dot 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 tensor Ej, and then I plus, and then all permutations of those indices I through, you know, I fix my indices I dot 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 up to j. But then I take all permutations of those indices, and I put a plus one in front of every even permutation, and I put a minus one in front of every odd permutation. So that's what this square bracket means. I've anti-symmetrized over these indices, just like I did here. It's a generalization of what I did here. So that is going to be only that's that space. If you check, will only have n choose p. Dimensions, so it's a subspace of the full space. So that's the space of p forms. And so now if I take the space of zero forms, direct sum with the space of one forms, direct sum with the dot dot dot, all the way up to the highest forms I can take, n forms, that direct sum is called the exterior algebra over lambda cn. It's the space of all p forms, all possible p forms. The highest p form is in n dimensions, is an n form here, because, you know, if I tried to take more than n basis vectors, if I tried to take p larger than n, then when I antisymmetrized, I would always get zero, if you think about it, because I would always have to have at least two basis vectors that were the same. So when I antisymmetrized, I would get zero from n. So yeah, think about that afterwards if you haven't thought about it before. But so that's why the n dimensions, you can only have zero forms up to n forms. So anyway, I take the direct sum of all of those. If you check, each subcomponent here has n choose p dimensions. So if I add them all up, the total dimension of this space, I recommend you check, is 2 to the n dimensions. So this thing is called the exterior algebra over Cn. I should say, so far I've just described it as a vector space. It's actually an algebra because I can take the product of any two guys, using the so-called wedge product. But we don't need that for for purposes of time. Let's just set that aside. Now what I want to say is, so in particular, let's look at lambda C5. So the exterior algebra in five complex dimensions. Well, that has zero forms, one forms, two forms, three forms, four forms, and five forms. If you count their dimensions using this n choose p formula, you'll see that they have one dimension 5, 10, 10, 5, and 1, respectively. So that adds up to 32, which is 2 to the 5 dimensional. Okay, this 2 to the 5, I remind you, was the dimension of the total space F plus FC of a single generation in the standard model. Okay, and so, but it's also what you expect here for lambda C5 when n is equal to 5. Okay, that's the first hint that there might be some connection. But what is the connection? Well, before I can show you I went too slow. Oh well, I apologize. So as always, I feel like I'm never quite. I can only somehow. I have a certain speed I run at, and it just cannot be. There's no accelerator or brake really. So I'll never catch up, and we'll always just be one slide over every lecture. Great. I'll finish this up at the beginning of next time. But then I really think it is true. I think the spin 10. I think the remaining two things are much quicker. So I think they're going to fit both in the next lecture. And we'll see. I'm destroying my credibility with each one of these. But anyway, I do think that'll be the case. In fact, I had even, like I say, I had even thought I was going to run over and move this last slide that your question was about to extra material. I thought I wouldn't get to it. It just shows a level of self-awareness, which I think you might not think I have, but I do, but I am gaining it over these lectures.